Juliet Dogcast Radio. If you like dogs, wherever you are in the world, we're the show for you. Hello, and welcome to episode 52 of Dogcast Radio. Before we get started, just a quick reminder that you don't have to listen to us sitting at your computer. You can download the show in a number of ways. If you have an iPod or other MP3 player, you can get us from iTunes or other podcast software, or you can burn us onto a CD and listen to us wherever you like. So don't leave us trapped inside the computer. Take us out and about with you. For more details, click the How Do I Listen button on any of the Dogcast Radio pages. I've been contacted by listeners James and Emma, who have recently lost their beloved German Shepherd, Joe. They are interested in finding another dog who resembles their Joe and would love to know which breeders some of the German Shepherd dogs on our breed page came from. So, if you posted pictures of Ozzy, Bigly Bambino, Grace, Herbie, or you are, in James's words, the gentleman with a bald head and his dog that's perfect but there's no name, if you're in the UK, please get in touch and tell us which breeder your lovely dogs came from. And James and Emma, you have my sympathies on the loss of Joe, of whom there is a lovely photo on our site. We've had an email from Tamara Lloyd, who runs the Alternative Animal Sanctuary in the UK, which takes in many animals turned down by other rescues. Tamara is dismayed by the plight of breeds such as Staffordshire Bull Terriers, Border Collies, Small Terriers and Lurchers, which find themselves in rescue more and more. Tamara has personally taken in 6 Staffies recently and is eager to find them loving new long-term homes. She points out that the dogs she has that need homes are the more common breeds rather than the more exotic breeds, or those with waiting lists, because they, she says, are lucky enough not to be thrown out. You can contact Tamara on 0781 840 6619. OK, in today's show, we have some excellent training advice about very different areas of training. First, we have Susie Arger, who is an expert on dog aggression.
Most what I see is all fear-based. It has underlining fear because they didn't have socialization as puppies.
Hannah Crook knows all about freestyle.
It's so much more fun than obedience. It's so much less strict, almost. In that you're having so much more fun with the dog. And the dogs seem to love it. They really do enjoy it. And it's a great way of keeping them active.
Plus, we have the Dogcast Radio News and a great new fiction feature. In order to really enjoy a dog, one doesn't merely try to train him to be semi-human. The point of it is to open oneself to the possibility of becoming partly a dog. Edward Hoagland. Susie Arger specialises in dog aggression. She is a certified canine behaviour and training specialist who received her certification from Triple Crown Academy. Aggression is, I guess, the behaviour we most fear in our dogs. How do you respond to it without making it worse? Can you cure it? Well, Susie has the answers, and I found her advice amazing, particularly with relation to how to socialise a puppy to countless different things to give him coping strategies. We started off with what forms aggression can take.
There's 5 different types of aggressions.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is dominance, territorial, fear-induced, predatory, aggression towards children, and aggression towards other dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so dominance is the one that we relate to the most, because most people think everything is dominant aggressive. Usually it's fear is the bottom line for most aggression.
Mm.
Lack of socialization is puppies.
Yeah, yeah. This is one of the things I wanted to ask you, sort of, perhaps if we could come back to that later, but basically,
sure.
When we start off with that little puppy that's a blank canvas, you know, hopefully is a happy, healthy blank canvas, how can we make sure we do the best and we our
okay.
train, you know, that perhaps we could come back to that. But, you know, with dominance aggression, how is that likely to manifest? And again, how do you treat that? How do you train against that?
Well, dominance aggression is, placement in the pack. I mean, if a dog's born in a very high placement in the pack or an alpha, they usually want to, that's, pack mentality. Nobody wants to be the lowest in the pack. So dominant aggression is usually coming from, obviously, a dominant dog, but a dog that is more likely to challenge its placement in the pack. Not like where its placement is, or to try to dominate every dog that comes around or every person that comes around. It's an innate behavior in them because that's pack mentality.
Yeah.
That's how dogs think.
Yeah, and how is that likely to, you know, what behavior is that dog going to display?
Usually they're overbearing. You know, they get up in a dog's face. Sometimes they want to do, you know, dominant postures on the dog, like humping them, putting their head on the back of their neck, pawing at them, trying to, you know, step on them. And for humans, it's sitting on the feet, leaning on them, pet me now, pet me now, pet me now. When they keep lifting your arm to pet you, those are all dominant behaviors.
Mm. And yet, I'm just thinking, often those are the things we sort of go, oh, look, he loves me. Look what he's doing.
Right. Right. Yes, we do that.
Mm.
Yeah, but that's you know, once you're established in the pack and you're higher and you're up in the hierarchy, then dogs can do certain things to you. But while you're trying to establish yourself in the pack, you can't allow them to do anything they wouldn't be able to do to another dog higher in the pack than them. So, I mean, I have a female border collie, and she is a born alpha. Born alpha. There's a difference between a born alpha and one that comes situational or environmental. But whatever a dog couldn't do to her, a dog can't do to me. They couldn't go and lean on her.
Mm.
She wouldn't have it. They couldn't sit on her feet. She would not have it. They couldn't take food from her. So that's how you have to. That's how I teach my clients to keep in the mindset of what you think is dominance and what's not. Whatever that dog couldn't do to a dog higher in the pack, they can't do to you.
Mm.
Once you're established, it's different. I have a dog, he'll come up and lean on me. He's not leaning on me for dominance. I'm already established with him. Does that make sense?
Yes, yeah. I'm glad about that because my dog leans on me as well.
Yeah, once you're established, it's totally different. But while you're trying to be established, you just remember, you know, if another dog wouldn't accept it, you can't accept it.
I suppose it's part of that sort of you set your rules early on, you know, when you bring the dog into your house, that's the rules, you know, and you stick to it. Yeah.
Exactly. You have to be consistent, and yes, you have to set up boundaries. And if you set them up immediately, then it puts the dog in their placement in the pack. If you don't set it up, then they find their placement, and it's usually going to be trying to be above you.
Mm.
And that's just pack mentality. That's just the way dogs think. Nothing personal.
So, I mean, when, you know, the advice you give then, I mean, is it that you don't let yourself get into that position or, you know, how? Because it's quite a difficult line to tread. You don't want to antagonize the dog, do you? So what do you actually do?
No, I mean, it's like if I'm working with a puppy and it's a dominant puppy, and I can already see signs that it's that. I mean, what I do is we do strict obedience training. They have to work for everything that they get. They have to sit before they get their leashes put on, sit to get their leashes taken off, wait at the door, sit before they get their food. It's managed. Mm. You manage this behavior, and you start teaching them, this is boundaries, this is what I'll accept, and this is what I won't accept. And that's when the dog, it can be a dominant dog, but it can't be dominant over you.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I have 5 very dominant dogs, but I'm still alpha. You know. So, I mean, it's called reversal of hierarchy if you have a dog that's an adult and it's a very dominant dog and it's been doing behaviors for quite some time that you didn't realize were dominant behaviors, you know, like leaning, sitting on the feet, pet me now, just coming up and taking things or jumping up on you disrespectfully. But it's a reversal of hierarchy, and it's actually these steps that you would do, you know, no gratuitous petting. You never go around them. You always go through them. Like if they're laying on the floor, I don't go around them. I will shuffle my feet and say, move. Because if you watch other dogs, when they're playing, one dog will come and just bowl over the other dog. And if that dog doesn't turn around and correct it, that dog will bowl over him again.
Yeah.
But if he turns around and correct him, he won't bowl over him again. He's established who he is.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they just actually, to start doing reversal of hierarchy, you know, the gratuitous petting is the main thing. If they get petted, if they do something, you not just because they come up to you and say, pet me now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, just to be clear, is that once you are, you know, can you relax that once you are established, or is that
Yes.
You know, yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Once you're established, no problem.
Yeah.
But you have to still maintain consistency or else, I mean, every day, you know, it'll be like, are you sure you're still in charge? Yes, I'm positive.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, one of my dogs at 5 o'clock, you still alpha? I'm like, yes, I'm still alpha. he's a very, very dominant male.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that something that's born in the dog? Is that innate or does that come about?
Yeah, well, dominance can, you mean, sometimes it's born where it's placement in the pack. Every dog's born a certain placement in the pack. Now, whether they stay that placement depends on situational and environmental.
Mm.
Okay? I mean, pack mentality is not to be the lowest in the pack. So you can have a very submissive dog with humans and be a very dominant dog with dogs. You can have a very submissive with dogs and very, very dominant with humans. It usually doesn't cross lines.
It's fascinating.
It is. It is. I mean, I'm an aggression specialist, so this is what I deal with the most. And it's like most what I see is all fear-based. It has underlining fear because they didn't have socialization as puppies.
Mm.
They weren't taught, you know, sounds, you know, loud sounds change, surfaces change, environments change. You know, it's like a child that travels a lot. They have coping skills.
Yeah.
Because things happen. Things are late. Your luggage gets lost. They have coping skills. But kids that don't travel do not have... Everything is a huge ordeal for them.
Mm.
You know, so it's the same thing with dogs. It's like if you take a dog everywhere and they're used to change and, you know, they sounds change and louder and this, then it becomes not so arousing for them. If they go to a dog park every day... Then going to a dog park is no big deal, but if they go once every 3 months, then they usually act like an idiot at the dog park because they have no social skills.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, now part of sort of social skills is, I suppose, sharing. If obviously, I'm not sure how much concept of sharing a dog has, but, you know, let's move on to, if we can term it, possessive aggression. You know, that might be, I've got this armchair or I've got this toy or, you know, something like that. How should we approach that?
That is under dominant aggressive. I mean, I'll be glad to answer the question, but there's possessive aggression is usually resource guarding. It's called resource guarding, where they guard beds and toys and food and, you know, that's a resource guarder. That's a very innate behavior in a dog. We just see it come out more now because people are having... more dogs and they're coming inside more and they're not living outside all the time because they've always had resource guarding. That's what animals do. They guard whatever resource that they have. But possession is, if you wanted to work on possession, you would do reversal of hierarchy as well as, it's called a mammoth bone exercise where you get this bone. It's like the size of an arm. It's just, it's like a femur. And you would hold it in the, and the dog's on leash, and you give it to the dog. The dog cannot hold the bone unless it lays down. You know, it's too heavy.
Yeah.
So he drops the bone. You keep giving it back to him. You are the resource that gives him back this toy or this bone. You try to work first with the mammoth bone, and then it shows that you can't do this without me.
Mm.
I'm the one that brings this to you. And the first thing about possession guarding is that you have to take away everything. They have nothing. They have no beds, they have no toys, they have no empty food bowls, they have nothing. And then you do obedience training, they get back things when they work for it. Resource guarding is, there's no cure for resource guarding. A dog will, if he's a resource guarder and he does that, that's in him.
Mm.
You just have to manage it. Aggression, there's no cure for aggression. It's all managed behavior.
So it's a bit, sorry, it just struck me, it's a bit like being, you know, a recovering alcoholic. You're never cured. You're going to have that problem, isn't it?
Right, exactly.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's true. Because, I mean, some trainers will say, I can cure your dog from aggression. Until this dog can speak and tell me they're cured, I mean, it could not come up for 5 years and scratch the surface. Something triggers it. A dog triggers it. A smell triggers it. Possession triggers it. Something. And then it's back, and it's just scratched the surface. So that's why you have to always look at it, since it's dangerous, you have to look at it as it's just managed.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, especially dog-on-dog aggression. You know, dog-on-dog aggression, you know, you do socialization exercises with other dogs, and the only time the dogs get anything is that's pleasurable, food, treats, whatever, is when another dog's around.
Mm.
We actually will put a dog in a pen, and I will walk by, and the dog gets nothing. I will walk by with another adult, the dog gets nothing. I walk by with a dog, the dog gets bacon. I walk by with two adults, dog gets nothing. And we just keep doing it. So the only time the dog gets something is when there's another dog with me. So they start looking for the dog, and they see, oh, it's just you. Where's the dog? Because the dog is associated with bringing this resource to them. We do the same thing with child aggression as well.
Yeah, yeah. So it's making a positive association rather than a negative one, isn't it?
Absolutely. The things that humans do wrong is that when a dog is dog aggressive, they jerk them and they yank them and they're yelling at them and they're doing all this stuff, which is very, it might be negative for us, but it could be a very positive experience for the dog because it's arousing.
Mm-hmm.
It's exciting. Things happening. So usually if people use negative reinforcement on dog aggression, the dog will see the other dog at a, like 50, 60, you know, 100 yards away, and he already starts the stress because it knows it's coming.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of him thinking something good is coming, now this big, huge ordeal with the jerking and the yelling and the, you know, him lunging at the leash and getting corrections and all that stuff is coming. So it's the buildup before it actually even gets there. So it doesn't get better that way. It gets worse.
Mm-hmm.
So now, you have to work at a distance for everything, and as they get better, you work closer and closer and closer.
Yeah, yeah. Now, another way that we can get things wrong is sort of how we, you know, again, we're talking about positive and negative, is if we punish our dogs, that can get a very bad reaction, can't it?
Right. Well, punishment is not teaching. It's punishment. You know, so you have to teach. So that's how dog, I mean, if you communicate with the dog, you're teaching them. If you just punish them, you're actually causing avoidance, and you're not changing the behavior. You're just causing an avoidance to it. You know, so that punishment does not work. Dogs correct each other, but they never punish. So if you wanted, if you teaching like you are a dog, is the way I teach. I'm an alpha dog. Is that I don't punish dogs. I will redirect them into an obedience exercise, and if they disobey the obedience exercise, I'll correct them for the disobedience on the exercise, not for lunging at another dog. Because if they're lunging at the other dog and I correct them, then every time a dog comes around, it's not a positive experience for them. I try to redirect them with food, but a very high motivating food. I mean, they get something really good when there's other dogs around. You know, so, I mean, you have to sometimes, you know, cut down the dog's food so they're hungry.
Yeah. So I guess are most of the people who consult you, they already have an aggressive in dog or a dog with aggressive problems rather than a puppy?
Yeah, you know, most people are wait till after the behavior is to the point where they can't deal with it. We have a lot of we do obedience training as well, so that's where you first start getting aggression under control if you have an aggressive dog. But yeah, the ones that call me have usually the dogs have bit somebody. And they usually say, oh, it just out of nowhere, he went after him. I'm like, no, dogs have about 6 different warning signals before they actually bite. So they don't know that you didn't pick up the warning signals. You know, I mean, a slight eye shift, just looking at another dog from their side, it's just a slight eye shift. That's a warning to another dog. You know, so if they could have done that, they could have done a hard stare where they stare at them really hard. You know, that's a warning signal. So usually by the time a dog bites, they've given you so many warnings that's what you push the dog to that level.
Yeah, yeah.
To correct them. And a lot of people will correct their dogs for growling, and I never correct a dog for growling because I need to hear that growl.
Yes.
I need to know that's the level that he is at now as far as his warning. If you take away that warning, they just go to the next level.
Yeah. All dog owners really need to read or train or somehow have an understanding of their dog's behavior, don't they?
Right. But it's anthropomorphism. They think that their dogs have human traits. And so they think we don't expect anything out of any other social animal the way we expect things out of dogs. We expect them not for us to be able to take food away from them. And when I tell people, like, can you take an apple? Would you take an apple away from a horse? A horse is a social creature. Mm. You wouldn't even think about it.
No, no.
You wouldn't even think about it. Would you take something out of a cat's mouth? You wouldn't
no.
even think about it. But mm. since it's a dog, we expect them to bloom these behaviors without teaching them.
Yeah.
You have to teach them what the boundaries and what's acceptable and what's not. Most people, you know, they want the result without going through the labor pains.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
So
let's have a look at the other end of the, you know, not when the problems have happened. You know, when we first get that little puppy, and mm-hmm. hopefully he's going to be a happy, healthy little puppy. What should we be doing with that puppy to make sure, to do our best to avoid aggression problems?
The socialization exercises and coping skill exercises. And what those are is we call it 7-7-7-7. And it's getting your dog around 7 different sized humans, and the humans come with something. The most bitten human is a 2-year-old, is a toddler, because they stretch their arms out and they yell and they waddle and they go straight into a dog's face.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't want a dog to be experiencing this at a year and a half. You need them to be experiencing this as a puppy. So they just know they can either avoid the child or something, but they're not. It's not a threat to them. So it's 7 different sized humans, 7 different surfaces. Okay, this is what teaches them coping skills. Dogs cannot stand slippery surfaces. They hate slippery surfaces.
Yeah.
So what we do is we'll get a garbage bag, a couple of garbage bags, and we'll tape them to the floor, and the dog has to walk down the hallway. It has to walk over them. They don't have to like it, but they have to be able to deal with it. And then, you know, I mean, hot sand. You know, hot sand is one of them. People will call me from the beach, and they'll say their dog won't get on the beach. And I'm like, didn't I tell you to socialize your dog to hot sand? Because it's different. That's a bizarre feeling for a dog. Don't wait till he's a year and a half old, and you're taking him to the beach. And if the sand is hot, and he puts his foot in it, and it goes up halfway up his arm,
yeah.
and he's like, "What is this?"
Mm-hmm.
You know. And then that's how we start teaching them coping skills: is 7 different surfaces, 7 different sized humans, 7 different environments, 7 different sounds. We get the sounds louder and louder. I get them socialized to motorcycles, and then objects. You know, I mean, dogs are neophobic. They're creatures of habit. They cannot stand change. They don't want anything to change. They don't want you to change your furniture, change your hair, change anything. Just leave everything the same. So, like, you can have a dog that lives in your house for, you know, however long, and if you put a box somewhere they're not expecting it to be, watch how your dog reacts to it. They'll walk up towards it, puff backwards, go forwards, go back. What is this? Why is this here? This is different. You know, so we do that with change, with objects. We'll turn chairs sideways. We put boxes places. Our goals with that is balloons, because most dogs hate balloons because nothing in their life moves that way. You know, nothing they've ever experienced moves that way. So that's why we keep doing this to puppies. So, you know, a very well-socialized puppy has excellent coping skills. If I can mow my lawn next to and the puppy's not freaking out, you know, most people wait till the dog's 6 or 7 months old, and now they have aggression towards vacuum cleaners. They're scared of, you know, blowers, you know, people that haul those things on their back and then blow the lawns.
Yeah.
I mean, they're scared of all these things because they haven't had experience with them as socialization as puppies. So you have to actually do these exercises. You know, and the more places you can take a dog, the more that they will have coping skills, because they have to adjust to something.
I'm just thinking. With your comment about, you know, you put a box somewhere in the house, and immediately the dog. Yeah, and you're right. You know, and I've seen it with my own dogs. And the things we expect them to understand. You know, for example, we moved house 6 months ago, and I mean, our dogs adapted very well, but you just expect them to understand that. You know, and
right.
we cut them some slack and sort of say, okay, you know. The first night, Buddy was a bit uncertain. But after that, you know, you just kind of think, well, we live here now. Come on.
Right, and we expect, dry cleaning bags, you know, that come, people that have a lot of dry cleaning, it's not that big of a deal. But if you're not a big dry cleaning person and you bring a dry cleaning bag into the house and you're carrying it back, and as it floats behind you, a lot of dogs will flip out. They've never seen anything move like that.
Yeah, yeah. And yet,
you know,
you think, you fool, it's just a dry cleaning bag.
We hang dry cleaning bags from ceiling fans, and we would use that as one of the objects we get dogs used to.
Mm.
Yeah, because especially by a vent, it moves. It kind of waves, and it moves, and dogs don't understand. Nothing in there, think about it, unless it's a curtain moving because of an air vent, nothing moves like that in their life.
No, no. And obviously, if it's something new, it might be something to be frightened of.
Right, but that's why we put treats around them, and we put treats around the boxes. We put treats around, we'll put a ball in a paper bag and put it on the floor. So if they touch it, it moves, and now they're, oh, my God, what is that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so then we put treats around it. So now when our dogs come in that we work on, they see something odd in the house, everybody runs to it to see what food is there. You know, so they're not. It's not a fear-based, it's a reward-based thing. So change to them is a good thing and not a scary thing.
Mm-hmm.
Most all aggression, bottom line, it had something to do with lack of socialization, fear-based, and, you know, the dominance is just born in them. But, you know, it's usually, what I see the most is fear-based, that the dog has no social skills. And mm-hmm. It feels the need to constantly be on guard, constantly protect itself, because as a puppy, it went nowhere.
Mm-hmm. So mostly it's people getting it wrong then, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's always the person's fault. It's never the dog's fault. Mm. Seriously, 99% of the time, all the incidences that I see or all the behavior that I see and the aggression and the problems are all human-caused.
Mm.
They're all human-caused. Very rarely. Usually if it's like one out of every 100 dogs might have a chemical imbalance that is causing this behavior. Usually it's human-caused.
Mm.
The humans jerk things away from them. They haven't taught them boundaries. They, you know, they have kids that tease the dog.
Mm.
They have dogs behind fences, and then they all walk another dog up to the fence, which causes huge aggression.
Mm.
It's a barrier frustration, cage aggression. So, I mean, it's usually all human-caused. So they'll take a dog up to another dog on leash and go, look, he's friendly. That other dog growls and snaps at that dog. Now that other dog, every time he sees a dog, is thinking this is what's going to happen.
Yeah.
You know.
Is the positive side of that, that if it's something we've put wrong, maybe we've got a good chance of putting it right?
Yes. If you can reverse this stuff, it takes longer with older dogs. But, yeah, that's why people need to get their dogs into training and go ahead and establish who they are and do socialization, teach the dogs coping skills. So these behaviors don't come up.
Mm.
They don't come up. You've socialized your dog enough that nothing really actually scares them. And if it does, you know how to work on it by that point.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It's fascinating, and it's a very complex area.
The dog pack mentality and the way dogs think is, you know, usually it's pretty simple, but it is, since aggression doesn't stay in one realm, I mean, dogs can be fear aggressive, dominant aggressive, have territorial aggression, have leash aggression, and be cage aggressive. So it can spread out,
mm-hmm.
not just one particular aggression that a dog will keep. It usually has other underlining aggressions in there, so they don't stay in one realm of aggression.
Balloons and dry cleaning bags. Incredible. To find out more about Susie, visit her website, atlantadogtrainer.com, and you can also hear her radio talk show, The Animal Hour, at radiosandysprings.com. We have links to both, and also quite a detailed biog of Susie on the Dogcast Radio site. I used to look at my dog, Smokey, and think, if you were a little smarter, you could tell me what you were thinking. And he'd look at me like he was saying, if you were a little smarter, I wouldn't have to. Fred Jungklaus. You're listening to Dogcast Radio on www.dogcastradio.com.
Hello and welcome to the Dogcast Radio News. I'm Kate.
And I'm Nick. The Companion Animal Protection Society, or CAPS, in America, is the only national non-profit organisation dedicated exclusively to protecting companion animals. CAPS' foremost concern is the abuse and suffering of pet shop and puppy mill dogs, and now you can help support them. CAPS is conducting an online auction called the Paws and Claws Shop through cmarket.com from November the 5th to the 30th, 2007. The purpose of the auction is to raise money and awareness for CAPS' critical work on behalf of pet shop and puppy mill animals. Founded in 1992, CAPS actively addresses this issue through investigations, education, media relations, legislative involvement, puppy mill dog rescues, consumer assistance, and pet shop employee relations. So, get bidding.
We love surveys that tell us how good our dogs are for us, and we've come across another one. A recent study found that dog walking is an excellent form of exercise and can help with weight loss. A slight adjustment to your diet, accompanied by daily 40-minute dog walks, can produce dramatic results. It's a great alternative to the gym, and of course, your dog's health will benefit too.
On the subject of dog health, British dog owners were recently warned about the cost of medical bills. There are around 11 million dog owners in Britain, and only half are covered by health insurance. Over a fifth of UK dog owners have had trouble paying for medical care, and many have had to use up savings, put off paying other bills, borrow money from family or friends, or even delay their dog's treatment. So, it's a clear message. Pet insurance is the best way to meet those veterinary bills.
Now, one of our recurring themes on this news is stories of dogs rescuing their owners. But here's one with a twist. In Maine, USA, Roland Coates' black Labrador Thumper woke him as his house burned around them. They made it to safety, although the house was ruined.
So, what was the twist in this tale?
Well, apparently it was the family cat that started the fire by knocking over a kerosene lantern.
I wonder if it did it on purpose. And finally, a warning about Halloween, which will soon be here.
Don't tell me you're scared of ghosts, witches and vampires.
No. This is about how to make sure our dogs enjoy Halloween as much as we do. The advice on offer includes providing a secure, pleasant environment for your dog to feel safe in. Play soothing music or keep a TV on for him, and make sure your dog doesn't sample any of the treats on offer. Remember, chocolate and dogs do not mix. You could buy your dog a new toy or a juicy bone to keep him occupied. Close your drapes, and if your dog tends to bark at the doorbell, disconnect it for the night and keep watch for trick-or-treaters instead. Be aware that some dogs will want a bite at dangling decorations or bits of costumes, and if you do take your dog out, keep him on a lead. It's a sad fact that around Halloween, pets can be stolen, injured or poisoned as part of pranks and rituals, so follow these safety tips to make sure Halloween doesn't get too scary. For more advice, check out doggeek.com and doggonesafe.com.
And do the safety tips tell us the best dog to have around at Halloween?
Well, I think it's got to be a bloodhound. So that's all from the Dogcast News Desk. Thank you for listening, and until next time, goodbye.
A Pekingese is not a pet dog. He is an undersized lion. A.A. Milne. Have you ever watched dogs dancing with their human and wondered how they get dogs to do that? And whether you and your four-legged friend might ever achieve such feats of synchronized movement? Well, Hannah Crook knows the secrets and has been involved in freestyle for a long time.
I actually started competing with freestyle about 6.5-7 years ago. It's a relatively new dog sport that's been around competition-wise for about 12 years now. They've been running competitions, but it's only recently been recognised by the Kennel Club as an actual sport with sort of full Kennel Club regulations and rules. And that was done about 3 years ago. And yes, I've competed for about that length of time, and I've also been judging for about 4 years, and I now train as well.
Brilliant, brilliant. And now, you've done so well, you are involved with quite a popular UK television programme at the moment, aren't you?
Yes, I was recently asked if I'd do be a trainer on the Richard and Judy show for Channel 4.
Yeah.
So there are six of us involved in that, and we're training up someone who hasn't done anything like this before, sort of starting from scratch to see how far we can get with sort of pet people and their dogs to have a bit of a laugh.
Oh, excellent. First of all, I don't know very much at all about freestyle, but it's divided into two sections, isn't it?
Yeah, there are two main categories. One is freestyle and one is heel work to music. And they're judged separately depending on the contents of each one. So heel work to music is mainly the dog in a heel work position, with interspersed with moves such as twirl, going around you, going through your legs, to move from one heel work position to another. And freestyle is more the moves and putting the moves together to music. So you obviously you have a little bit of heel work, but the majority of the routine is actually freestyle moves.
So freestyle, you'd have more freedom to interpret the music, sort of thing.
Yes, you have. You work with the dog's sort of physiology as to what the dog can do and what the dog is capable of doing, and try and interpret the music as best as possible with the movements of yourself and the dog. Freestyle gives you a lot more freedom to do work at a distance, work behind you. It's slightly more complicated with the difficulty level, although that'll probably not go down too well. I actually do both with my dogs, so
yeah,
and I find both equally challenging. But you are less constrained with the freestyle than you are with heel work.
Yeah, yeah. And do you, presumably you work with your own dogs, do you?
Yes, I have. At the moment, I've got 4 dogs, one of whom is retired, and 2 of whom I work at the moment. One is a rescue who I've taken on, who I won't do anything with. But I have a rescue gun dog cross who I work mainly in heel work, heel work to music. And I have a little collie cross who I work mainly in freestyle.
The collies seem to do incredibly well at that, don't they?
They do. It's funny, really, because the freestyle tends to be the one sport that doesn't discriminate you if you don't have a collie. You tend to find in agility and obedience and things now, the collies very much dominate the top levels, simply because you can train and train and train and they never get fed up.
Yeah.
You do tend to find with other breeds, they switch off much quicker. So mainly people do this as a hobby and you don't have time to sort of come back and train the dog for 10 minutes every few hours. People tend to go for collies. But with the freestyle, you do tend to be marked if you have a dog that is slightly more different. So, I mean, there are a lot of Belgian Shepherds. There's a lot of, there's a few boxers that do it. There's quite a few small dogs that compete as well.
Yeah.
And poodles are becoming very common.
Because they're intelligent.
They're very athletic as well. So it's really nice because you get such a huge variety of breeds competing. It's really good fun to watch.
Yeah, yeah.
An excellent spectator sport.
Yes, yeah. Presumably, talking about sort of the different breeds that do it, I was going to say, presumably, it's more difficult with, like, a big dog. For example, you know, a Great Dane might be very difficult to do this kind of work with. What's the optimum size, or isn't there? It just depends on the dog and the person.
There isn't one, to be honest. There was a woman competing with a Great Dane. She is the only one I've seen. Unfortunately, it was not a young Great Dane, and it recently died. But I did see her working that, and it worked really nicely because with freestyle, there's no set thing that you have to do. It's all what you can do with your dog, and you work in. This is why I like it so much, simply because you have so much freedom. There is nothing set that you have to do. Whereas with obedience, you have to do the heel work, you have to do the recalls. With agility, obviously, you have to do the jumps. This is all your own work, and you work with your dog's physiology. So if your dog can't do something, it doesn't matter, because it's going to be capable of doing something else.
Yes, yeah.
And you just work with what your dog is capable of doing, which is really nice.
Yeah, yeah. So it's only limited by sort of what you can think up, isn't it?
Your imagination and your dog's capabilities, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Which can be quite challenging.
Yes. Yeah, that's... Because, as you say, it's all coming from you. There isn't a book that you can get and just do follow this ABC and it will happen. You've got to have much more of an input, haven't you?
You do. I mean, there are several videos around, several training videos that people have brought out, and there are a couple of books around now about sort of training basic tricks and just starting yourself off. But really, it is all down to you. And this is where, I mean, I've found it. I've competed at obedience, I've competed at agility, I've competed at flyball. I've had a little bit of a go at working trials, but not a huge amount. And this, I've found, has been the hardest so far, simply because you are completely on your own. When you walk into that ring, you are in a sort of like 20 by 25 metre square ring with a panel of judges watching you, and it's all you. There's no one telling you what to do.
Yeah.
It's all your own work that you have had to work up to.
Yeah.
And it's terrifying.
Yes.
That's terrifying.
Yeah, yeah. Did you say you've judged as well?
Yes, I have.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now, what do you look for then when you're judging?
Well, like I was saying earlier, the Kennel Club before, about 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago now, the Kennel Club set up a working party. To sort of try and, because it is obviously very difficult to judge something like a Dachshund against a Collie.
Yeah.
So they set up, they tried to set up a fair judging criteria so that you were looking at certain aspects rather than discriminating against what a dog can do. You were looking at different sections of it.
Mm.
And they've split it actually into three different sections. So you get 10 marks per section. And the first section is your program content, which sort of goes with what moves you've got, basically that the movement of the dog should be more than the handler, the movements should be appropriate to the dog, so you don't do anything that's damaging the dog, obviously.
Mm.
And the degree of difficulty of the move should be taken into account as well. So, for example, someone who asks a dog to twirl with a hand signal will get less marks than someone who just does it on a verbal cue.
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah.
The second section is the accuracy and the execution of the movement.
Mm.
And that's obviously, again, that comes into to how smooth the movements are, how flowing it is, how nicely, how well the dog works, how promptly the dog responds.
Mm.
That looks at the whole handler and dog team as well.
Mm.
And then your third section is your musical interpretation. So that's obviously your choreography, how well the dog fits in with the moves, whether the music is a good choice of music for that dog.
Mm.
And sort of that's how it's actually marked. But it is a very difficult... They actually have three judges.
Yeah.
Because obviously no matter who you get to judge it, it's all going to be very subjective.
Yes.
To how difficult you feel a move is to train. One person might think it's very easy, another person might have found it very difficult. It's all going to be based on your own personal experience. So having the three judges sort of evens out, and then an average is taken of the three judges' scores.
Yeah.
And that gives you your final mark.
Mm-hmm. Which is easiest for you, competing or judging?
That's quite a difficult one, actually.
Mm.
Possibly judging. I had a lot of problems when I first started competing. I had terrible nerves going into the ring, and I found it very, very difficult. And because I got stressed, obviously I transmitted that to my dog.
Mm.
And I was fine with my first dog, the one who's now retired, because he was an angel, and he's like a little darling. He just does what he's told no matter what, despite me. And then my next dog is quite a sensitive. My other little collie cross, she's a sensitive little soul, and she would pick up very much on what I was doing, and we would stand in this huge great big ring, and I'd tell her to do something, and she'd look at me as if to say, no, I've never heard that word before. And so it sort of became I used to get terrible nerves going into the ring.
Mm.
Which I've just about overcome now. I wouldn't say completely, but just about.
The trouble is you don't know what mood the dog is in that day. What's going to distract him?
Yeah, it's very, very hard, obviously, to gauge. I mean, the training, that there is no situation you can set up that is exactly like a competition. A lot of people who compete do lots of demos at school fetes, at open days and things like that, to actually help try and create a bit of that atmosphere and give the dog a little bit of practice in competition-like situations. But it is, yes, it's very hard because there is not really anything you can do to recreate that. And, of course, your own stress as well, which accounts a lot for how the dog behaves.
Yeah, yeah. I have to say, when the freestyle, you know, and the heel works music, it's something that when you see it done well, you kind of think, oh, I'd love to have a go at that. That looks brilliant,
yeah,
you know.
It's wonderful. It's a great way. It's one of the few ways it really does reflect the bond between the handler and the dog when it's worked properly. I mean, the guy I used to work for a long time, he was the top freestyle handler in the country.
Mm.
And you would watch him and you could feel that you knew the dog was working on his commands, but it looked like it was working completely independently of him.
Yeah.
And that just showed the bond so well that he had with that dog.
Mm.
It was amazing to watch.
Yeah, yeah. If there are people listening to this, and I'm sure there are, thinking, I'd fancy having a go at that. How do we start? You know, if we've never done anything like this before, how do we start?
Okay. There are two main organisations within Freestyle at the moment. One is Canine Freestyle GB, mm-hmm. and the other is Paws and Music. Both of them have websites, and the first thing I would do is probably get in contact with someone on those websites, because they have networks all over the country of people who do training sessions and things, and that would obviously be a good basis to start, possibly getting in contact with someone who does classes mm-hmm. with Freestyle, or getting in contact and finding a lot of people run workshops over the country, so sort of day-long workshops for beginners or for choreography and things.
Hmm.
And going on a workshop will obviously give you some good ideas. But there are a few books around. I mean, obviously, the initial thing you need is a good basis of obedience. So a dog that's going to listen to you when you sort of tell it to stay close to you. And all of Freestyle and heel work is done off the lead.
Yes.
So none of it is actually worked on the lead. So you need a dog that's going to stay with you and be confident working with you.
Mm. Mm. So, well, you just cut Buddy out there, I'm afraid.
Oh, right.
Well, if there was somebody, an interesting person or dog around, I mean, he's fairly good, but if there's an interesting dog or person around, he's like, I'd like to meet them now, thank you.
Right. Oh, dear.
So, a little more work on that, perhaps, but yes.
Yes, possibly.
So, okay, smashing. Well, is there anything else that you'd like to say about Freestyle before we finish?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it really is an excellent way of building up a bond with your dog, and it's such good fun. I mean, I've got to the point now with my little 7-year-old collie cross where I'm running out of things to train her. She does all sorts of weird and wonderful things, a lot of which are kind of no use really at all, like she'll stand up and cross her paws, or she'll cover her face with her paw and things, which is great. And even if I didn't compete, I would carry on doing it, because it's so much more fun than obedience.
Mm.
It's so much less strict, almost.
Yeah.
In that you're having so much more fun with the dog. And the dogs seem to love it. They really do enjoy it. And it's a great way of keeping them active and having a bit of fun with your dog.
If you fancy having fun with your dog, trying a bit of Freestyle, there are some links on the Dogcast Radio site you might like to explore. And Hannah's training advice is also on offer through chilldogs.com. The world was conquered through the understanding of dogs. The world exists through the understanding of dogs. Nietzsche. We met author Bernard Cartwright in episode 46 when he told us about his book, The Knock Nobbler. His work as a dog catcher in Worcester brought him into contact with many dogs and people. Here he tells the story of how he helped sort out one noisy dog.
It is Monday the 27th of September 1999, and this is Maria's story. Today I received a phone call from a professional gentleman in a posh part of Worcester. Mr. Hiram Blaust was upset by some early morning barking, which was fretting his night owl daughter, just down from university. He gave me, in his own meek manner, the description of every whimper, howl and yelp, and in return eliciting from me the law's remedy concerning what magistrates would consider a public nuisance. I promised to make a visit and deal with it informally for him. I arrived at the nearby Georgian residence in question, and my ringing of the bell was met by a dog skidding joyously across the polished parquet floor in anticipation of the return of a loved one and not me. The dog then went crashing crump into the other side of the door. This was then opened in an expansive flourish by the charming Mrs. Maria Carissimi, who appeared immediately the sort of person who would understand other people's feelings. She was dressed in a casually sophisticated way, resembling an older Natalie Wood from West Side Story. On initially scrutinising my uniform, she welcomed me over the threshold, and in a typically affable American manner, she said, "Come right in. What's your name?" "Bernard Cartwright." "You are very welcome, Bernard." I followed Mrs. Carissimi along a cavernous hall and into a kitchen. A little girl and a young red setter attended. "Look, I've had a bad day. Would you like a cocktail?" I replied, "I know all about bad days, but I'd like a cup of your coffee, please." "My name is Maria Carissimi from Lackawanna, New York State. Are you from the police?" No, I'm the city dog warden." "Gee, Bernard, that's swell. Do you like your work?" She started the coffee machine, so I had to speak up. "Yes, very much, thank you. So, how can I help you?" "It's about your lovely dog here. Does he bark early in the mornings? I mean loudly and outside. I've had a complaint about the noise."
"Does he bark in the mornings? You mean the council have come round here to talk to me about my dog? He barks at 6 a.m. because I go to work at 6 a.m. Dogs bark. You English are so lazy. What's the matter with you all? I am in the service industry, employing well over 200 staff in my chain of hotels, and I work harder than any of them. What gives with this English disease? Aren't you well up for work?"
"Have you got all day?" "Basically, of course, like much else, it's rooted in vanity." She moved over to me and mildly caressed my shoulder.
"Well, my dog is just fine. Look, see for yourself. Look at the setter. Anyway, who's made this complaint?"
"It's not the dog, but the noise which is at issue here, madam, and I'm not at liberty at this stage to disclose the name of the complainant."
"So, Bernard, what happens if I don't, or even I can't do as you ask? I do know something about loud music, you know, because of our hotels.
We have a device called a matron."
"Am I actually hearing this? You have a what?"
"It's a tape recorder which can run for a week, and through using time code, we can pinpoint the incidence and intensity of the barking. We then put the recording before the magistrates to consider it as a statutory nuisance and ask for a noise abatement order."
"Wow!"
I then played a little while with her red setter and her child. The girl asked me, "Why do puppies bite, not hurt? They don't hurt me." So I explained that in a litter each dog learns what pressure to apply to other puppies. But interjecting, the girl whispered, "It's because Pudding loves me so much." A child and a pudding in love, so perfect. The fabulous Mrs. Carissimi then walked over and touched my shoulder once again, with the finesse of a brushmaker's bristle dresser. Her digits did not turn sensual. Many an old chimney can catch fire, so a hardened sinner like myself has learned to discern motives in such situations as these.
"Look, Bernie, tell the neighbours I'm only mortal, will you? So I'll fix up a bourbon party and just invite everybody round, and we'll sort it out that way. And I'll be glad to meet your mystery person who doesn't want to talk to me about my own dog to my face."
I did pass this information on to Mr. Blaust, and Mrs. Carissimi was as good as her word, and I never did go back.
Rambunctious, rambustious, delinquent dogs become angelic when sitting. Dr. Ian Dunbar. Jill, who has recently been reunited with her poodles, sent me the following story. "I have searched, but can't find an author to credit. If you wrote this, or you know who did, please let us know and we'll credit you. I hope you like this as much as I do." Mary and her husband Jim had a dog named Lucky. Lucky was a real character. Whenever Mary and Jim had company come for a weekend visit, they would warn their friends to not leave their luggage open, because Lucky would help himself to whatever struck his fancy. Inevitably, someone would forget and something would come up missing. Mary or Jim would go to Lucky's toy box in the basement, and there the treasure would be, amid all of Lucky's other favourite toys. Lucky always stashed his finds in his toy box, and he was very particular that his toys stay in the box. It happened that Mary found she had breast cancer. Something told her she was going to die of this disease. In fact, she was just sure it was fatal. She scheduled the double mastectomy, fear riding her shoulders. The night before she was to go to hospital, she cuddled with Lucky. A thought struck her. What would happen to Lucky? Although the three-year-old dog liked Jim, he was Mary's dog through and through. If I die, Lucky will feel abandoned, Mary thought. He won't understand that I didn't want to leave him. The thought made her sadder than thinking of her own death. The double mastectomy was harder on Mary than her doctors had anticipated, and Mary was hospitalised for over 2 weeks. Jim took Lucky for his evening walk faithfully, but the little dog just drooped, whining and miserable. Finally, the day came for Mary to leave the hospital. When she arrived home, Mary was so exhausted she couldn't even make it up the steps to her bedroom. Jim made his wife comfortable on the couch and left her to nap. Lucky stood watching Mary, but he didn't come to her when she called. It made Mary sad, but sleep soon overcame her, and she dozed. When Mary woke, for a second she couldn't understand what was wrong. She couldn't move her head, and her body felt heavy and hot. But panic soon gave way to laughter when Mary realised the problem. She was covered, literally blanketed, with every treasure Lucky owned. While she had slept, the sorrowing dog had made trip after trip to the basement, bringing his beloved mistress all his favourite things in life. He had covered her with his love. Mary forgot about dying. Instead, she and Lucky began living again, walking further and further together every day. It's been 12 years now, and Mary is still cancer-free. Lucky? He still steals treasures and stashes them in his toy box, but Mary remains his greatest treasure. Till next time, look after yourselves and your dogs.
Thanks for listening to Dogcast Radio, available from www.dogcastradio.com. That's dogcastradio.com. If you'd like to get in touch with us, and wherever you are in the world, we'd love to hear from you. You can do so in a variety of ways. By phone from the UK, you can contact us on 0121 288 0922. From the US, you can contact us on our American number, which is 315 849 2022. From any other country, you'll need your international exit code and then 44121 288 0922. You can contact us on Skype with the ident Dogcast Radio. That's all one word, Dogcast Radio. By email, you can contact me on julie@dogcastradio.com. When contacting us by email, if you have the facilities, please record your questions or comments and send them to us as an audio file. That way we can include them directly in our programme. We can accept most formats, for example, WAV, MP3. All these methods of contacting us can be found on our website, which is www.dogcastradio.com. And as ever, the final word goes to Jenny.
If there's H2O on the inside of a fire hydrant, what's on the outside? K9P.